Hi, and welcome to the Pareto podcast. We have come to episode 30, which will be done in English as for an international audience, and since my guest today is a native English speaker. The theme of the day is the oil market, which is in, there's a lot of interest in that right now. And just to give you some flavor of it, oil is the most traded commodity in the world. It's used in many products, plastic, etc., asphalt, but it's mostly a proxy for world energy price. So what the price of oil is really meaningful for a lot of countries in the world. Many countries, most of them actually are oil importing countries, so a high oil price is like a tax for those countries. But of course there's some on the other side of the line, like Norway, which benefits greatly from a higher oil price. Oil is often produced very far from where it's used. It's transported over long distances, and it must generally also be processed before end used, which is done in large refineries of various size all over the world. It's rather bulky and thus expensive to store, so it's produced, transported, refined, and then consumed. In a cycle, that's fairly fast, actually. The average time in storage, it's around 30 days, between 30 and 40 days. And the price has recently dropped from around 86 at the top in October to the low 60s right now. So a lot of people want to know why and what does this mean and what we are seeing going forward. So it's a pleasure to introduce our oil analyst, Nadia Martin-Wiggen. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much.
So you're in great demand these days from investors and brokers and other participants. It's busy days.
It is very busy because we've had so much volatility and the picture in terms of the oil market has changed a lot. Yes, since where we were in the summer when we had our last podcast through to October to where we are sitting here today now.
Yeah, I just want to remind the listeners that you can go back to our episode 23 to get more of the background in the oil market, because I had you as a guest then and talked a lot about that. But maybe you can just walk us through it. When we were in the beginning of October, the price was 86. And the theme internationally was that there's not much oil, we need more oil, the price is going to 100. And then it didn't. So what happened on the supply and demand side? There's a lot of things, it's not just one thing, but can you at least give us some flavor?
Yes, well, since the summer, there was high demand visible globally for oil. And because we had sanctions coming forward on Iran, we had concerns about Venezuela, that their oil production was declining so quickly, OPEC and Russia agreed that they needed to ramp up their production levels to actually fulfill demand, especially when the world was worried that we might start to see demand destruction in countries like India.
Demand destruction is when oil simply gets too expensive, so people start to switch to coal and other things,
and
you know,
other
for energy.
Sources. Mm. Exactly, or not driving their cars and walking or taking public transport. So this is why OPEC and Russia decided to step in. In addition, they had a lot of pressure from President Trump, who likes to have low oil prices for the U.S. consumer.
Yeah, and for the midterm elections.
Yes, exactly. So October, the market looked very, very strong. Unfortunately, sometimes it looks its best at the top. And then the Iranian sanctions were supposed to come into full force 3 days before the U.S. election, midterm election. And the expectation globally was that it would mean that countries like India would no longer, and Europe would no longer be allowed to import Iranian crude. Now, the Trump administration had said, we may grant some waivers to some purchasers of Iranian crude. And from my perspective, I thought there was a risk that he might grant waivers to India, which had been complying, as in choosing not to buy as much oil from Iran as before. South Korea that had also demonstrated good behavior by cutting down on the amount of oil they were purchasing. But I thought India or South Korea or Europe, not all of them together. So instead of granting waivers to one or two countries, the Trump administration granted waivers to eight countries.
And then the sanctions don't really mean anything, do they?
Well, they're not that effective. He kept Northern Europe and out of the waiver group, but Southern Europe was allowed to continue to buy Iranian crude. So that caught analysts off guard, and I think that even caught OPEC and Russia off guard, because when they were planning to increase production, they had expected Iran to be unable to export as much crude. So they were already planning to compensate for this November deadline when Iranian crude exports would really drop off, because the U.S. had repeatedly targeted zero exports out of Iran. In October, Iran was still exporting around 1.6 1.8 million barrels per day of crude. So it's quite a big drop off in terms of the expectation of crude. So OPEC and Russia believe they needed to increase their oil supply to compensate for that.
And this is the balance in the market between supply and demand is fairly delicate, actually. So if there's a million barrels too much of production, prices go down. And if there's a million barrels too little, prices tend to go up a lot.
Yes, exactly. And this is where the mathematics didn't work out as the producers expected, that being OPEC and Russia. But they worked out very well for President Trump, because he managed to keep the oil price down and actually push it down further while granting these Iranian waivers. But of course, they're temporary waivers and they expire in April. So again, there will be another round. So in October, what happened is that first we started to have big fears on the demand front. One, because the oil price was so high at the start of the month. But more importantly, there was a feeling that we are approaching a recession in the U.S. GDP expectations for China and the U.S. were looking lower. For Europe, we're looking lower because of Brexit. A lot of political discord. We had Argentina falling apart. So the concern on a macroeconomic level globally really weighs in on the demand expectations then of who the oil buyers are going to be and how much they can afford to buy. So first we actually saw the demand expectations coming down before we physically saw this additional oil actually overwhelming the markets. Because at the beginning, the refineries, they still continued to buy oil, and then some were going into maintenance season in October. So when a refiner is in maintenance, they're not buying oil, because they don't like to store that much oil on site because there's a cost involved, right?
Yeah.
So they stop buying a bit. Then we have the first bit of this surge in production coming. And then the general expectations in the world on how much oil we need started to plummet. Then we fast forward two more weeks and we start to see the actual increase in production coming out of Saudi Arabia, coming out of Russia, coming out of the United Arab Emirates. Then in addition to that, we have all of the U.S. Oil companies that are producing shale.
Yeah, and they surprised on the upside as well, didn't they?
Exactly. And in September, we first saw that there was a ramp up in production in the Gulf of Mexico, because you normally have around a 2 month delay before you get the facts on the data.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw that actually the Gulf of Mexico had jumped quite a lot. And then we then had to think about, okay, that production. And then shale surprised even more to the upside.
Which shale is the onshore production.
Is the onshore production, right? And so then that added on top of what was already a higher base number from the U.S. than what the market expected in June, when OPEC and Russia were deciding how much they need to ramp up production by. You know, the U.S. was actually producing more than they thought. So then we got those numbers later in October that we could see that they were ramping up production. Russia had ramped up quite a bit. And then we saw in November that Saudi Arabia ramped up even more. And Russia only ramped up a little bit. They were almost flat. And the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, they ramped up even more. And you know, to be honest with you, this even caught Russia off guard because they didn't think that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates would be increasing production that much more. And this is where, you know, there was an OPEC meeting last week. And part of the difficulties around that is that Russia was very upset with Saudi Arabia that they had increased production so much to flood the market and then put this in this difficult situation.
So we had a situation where oil dropped almost every day from the mid-80s and down to 60, where it seems to have settled a little bit. And then last week we had an OPEC meeting and there was an agreement there finally reached between OPEC and Russia.
Yes.
What was that?
So they agreed that they had provided too much oil for the market. Mm-hmm. And that they needed to again cut production.
Just like they did a few years back.
Exactly, like they decided in December 2016. The market had, you know, a lot of analysts, myself included, at Pareto, had put forward how much production they need to cut from the October level, which was the midpoint of the ramp up, because November was an even higher ramp up. But October were the last facts that we all had, what was the production number. And that includes OPEC themselves because there is a time delay. And we at Pareto called for a 1.4 million barrel per day cut in production against our demand expectations for next year. However, we wanted the following countries to be exempt from the cuts. They include Iran, Libya, Venezuela, and Mexico. The reason these countries should be exempt is because in our forecast, we actually see year-on-year oil production declining from those countries.
Yeah.
Therefore, if you tell them to cut from the October level, it's not a real cut because they're going to quite easily comply unless you give them an enormous number in terms of their specific target. However, the OPEC agreement with Russia, what they came out with for a total cut for everyone was 1.2 million barrels per day. So that falls short of the Pareto call for 1.4 million barrels per day by 200,000 barrels. But they did exempt at least three of the four countries we wanted them to exempt. So they exempted Iran, Venezuela, and Libya. They did not exempt Mexico. So because we see Mexico production declining 200,000 barrels per day year on year, according to the OPEC math, they actually needed to add 200,000 barrels per day. So from our perspective, they fall short by 400,000 barrels per day, which is quite a big number to fall short by. To give a sense to the audience, the amount of oil production that we saw in terms of the jump in the second half of last year, you know, once the decision was to increase production and into, you know, the October period, was that the U.S. produced 1.2 million barrels per day more.
Yeah.
And Saudi Arabia, Russia, and the United Emirates together produce 1.2 million barrels per day more. So when we are looking at their cut, and those are only those three countries, right? So when we're looking at their cut actually isn't that impressive versus where they were already. So they've been very cautious in terms of how much oil they plan on cutting down in terms of what they provide to the market.
Well, anyway, it seems to have more or less stabilized the oil price, and it's settled down here at 60. And we'll get to it later in the podcast. Your price forecasts going forward. But there's another theme that's rather big now in the oil and energy markets. It's called and named IMO 2020. And IMO, if I remember correctly, is an International Maritime Organization. Mm-hmm. And 2020 is the date where they put the new regulations into place for fuel for boats for international shipping.
Yes.
New rules that they have to comply by, which, if I'm correct, means less sulfur in the fuel. So it's less poisonous, to put it bluntly, for the sea.
Yes. So the way the regulations have been is that, you know, globally you could use up to 3.5% sulfur as your fuel oil in shipping, right? In Norway, however, and in the US, on the US coast, they are much more environmentally conscious. You're only allowed to use 0.1% sulfur fuel oil. So it doesn't make a change here, but for the rest of the world, when we think about, you know, China, Asia, South America, it is a very big difference because the new rule says only 0.5% sulfur.
Yeah, and so a lot of new fuel has to be made, actually, which makes that you have to build new refineries to make all this, or you have to do upgrades to a lot of refineries to be able to make more fuel for international shipping.
Exactly. The specification now for the fuel is so different that we don't even call it fuel oil anymore. You used to have high sulfur fuel oil, which was 3.5%, and low sulfur fuel oil, which was 1.5%. And that's what the majority of the world used for shipping.
Mm.
And now we're talking about 0.5%. And so we call it marine gas oil.
Yeah,
and gas oil is more like a heating oil that you use for your house.
Is it more like traditional diesel?
It's, it is more similar, like, but it is, of course, more sulfurous than the kind of diesel we put in our cars.
And sulfur is a part of oil when you put it up, take it up from the ground. Crude oil has some sulfur in it, so it has to be removed in the refineries.
Exactly, and a lot have desulfurization units, but there are limits on what a refinery can do. And when we think of, you know, a refiner takes crude oil, puts the oil in, and then it gets products out, right? American refineries, they make primarily gasoline. They do not make so many distillates because American drivers use gasoline. They don't use diesel.
No.
And so that is a different type of product than what we're actually talking about now that the shipping industry is using. So the distillates, which includes diesel, jet fuel, now marine gas oil, that is what European refiners are more geared towards making. So this is where it's, you know, the world's largest refining country is the U.S., and they don't make the product that we actually need to fulfill the demand of worldwide shipping.
And who does?
And, well, so Europeans have made it. India makes it. China makes it. China, with its industrialization, makes a lot of distillate. However, they don't make enough to suddenly fulfill all the needs of the entire shipping industry. And when we look at the investments being made to refineries, they're not actually being made in the US. They're being made in primarily Asia. So the expectation and planning that the refining industry has made is that increasingly we are going to run all of this oil, crude oil and condensate, in refineries in Asia, you know, in countries also like Turkey, India, even a little bit in Africa, but primarily China, to create this fuel that the entire global shipping industry requires.
Mm. Well, this is what kind of makes your computations very complicated, because it's not just supply and demand, it's also various products, and it's where it's stored and where it's produced. And then again, you can see a picture here, for instance, of oil being produced in Europe, sent to China, processed, and then you send back the fuel for shipping. So it creates more demand
on the entire tanker market, because it's not as efficient as when you could just send the oil in a pipeline to a U.S. refiner and then send the product back out. Now you actually have to be using tankers globally to shift it around.
Yeah, but anyway, at the margin, this IMO 2020 will mean, if I'm correctly in your computations, a little bit more oil in storage and a little bit more oil in transportation. Or product oil.
Yes, and especially more oil needing to be run. So it's also temporarily stored. But for example, or specifically, I see nearly 3 million barrels per day of additional refinery capacity coming online by the end of next year, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those are brand new refiners. So we must think of them as brand new consumers to the market. The numbers we have been talking about, of course, a refinery doesn't have to run at maximum capacity, but a refinery needs to run at least 50%, really 60%, or you have damages. It's like turning off your refrigerator. It's bad. And so we now have these new buyers in the market that need to fulfill their refinery to create the product that we require. However, there are some products that we don't need as much of. The jump in gasoline demand globally is not as high as the jump in distillate demand. So this is where it becomes quite complicated. But the most important thing is that these refiners are coming online. They need to put oil in their refinery, and then they need to create the marine gas oil that the tankers can then use, and all the shipping industry for everything that they ship can then use on a global level. And this is a very big change coming to the market.
And this is included in your demand forecasts now?
Yes.
Good. Well, to switch to the other part of the industry here, we are now at the end of the year. And this is what's called planning season for the big oil majors. It's when they sit down and make their or adjust their plans going forward. Do we have any flavor of what they are talking about or thinking about now? Because I guess the atmosphere in the room must be a little bit different when it's oil is at 80 than when it's at 60.
Absolutely. In September, October, which is when they tend to do the start of their planning season, the mood was very strong and the expectation was a lot of FID's final investment decisions being made now in the end of the year and next year to bring on big projects offshore. Now there's been a little bit of holding back, even also in the US market on amongst the shale producers and amongst the super majors that produce shale. So Chevron, Exxon, and Shell, they're very involved in the Permian Basin in US shale. But there has been so much volatility since October. The market has been all over the place that this is a nightmare for financial planning for majors. So they wanted to hear what OPEC and Russia would decide before they could decide what their base case oil price outlook is for next year so that they could plan things. So I think on the shale side, in the first quarter, for example, a lot of decisions had already been made. So there is some spending decided. However, with this lower oil price, it's bad for some of their free cash flow. So they are already looking to be overspending a little bit with prices where they are now. And the general view is that they have stabilized for right now. So it's these next few months, we will hear probably at the start of the year, especially what is the actual CapEx planning by these companies, and we'll see more clearly. But the $25 drop in 2 months is very difficult for long-term planning.
It's very interesting, this, and I guess a lot of people will be listening to what the oil majors and the other oil companies will be saying. Just to give some flavor to the two listeners here, when we do an adjustment or a change in our oil price forecast, that's the price that goes in as an input into all our oil company forecasts as well. And I think when I counted them yesterday, that we are covering 28 oil producers. So the input price, of course, is very important for the valuation of those kind of companies. And following our adjustment of the oil price forecast yesterday, we had to take down our recommendation and target price of Equinor, the largest Norwegian producer, from target price of 300 and a buy recommendation to target price of 170 and a sell recommendation, actually. So this means a lot. And looking at the free cash flow computation for Equinor, we see it being cut in half, actually, since our last update in October, November, so or September, October. So it really means a lot, and not at least to the oil services crew. And we've seen a hard sell-off globally in oil services companies the last couple of months, and I guess it's not a stretch to say that it's connected with the atmosphere in the room when it comes to the oil companies in their planning season, because I think the theme is that they might not need to hurry so much going into to enforce larger projects into 2019, it's a more wait and see attitude.
Yeah, and make decisions more slowly. So instead of FIDing everything at once, they can go at a slower pace.
So when we finally then end up at our oil price forecast, you adjusted it down yesterday. How do you see it develop going into 2019 now?
Yes, so our new oil price forecast is for $71 Brent for next year.
Still almost 10 up from where we see it today.
So. Yes. However, we first see the oil price going lower in the first quarter for next year. So for next year, the forecast is for $56 for Brent. And that is really driven by the WTI US market. That's where we need to see WTI at under $50. So $47 is our forecast. Mm-hmm. And why under $50? At $50 WTI...
Just cut in here and remind the listeners that Brent is the North Sea reference oil and WTI is the American reference oil. So it's those two names that you... And they tend to be, at least as it is now, close to $10 in price difference between them.
Yes, exactly. Historically, though, WTI was more expensive than Brent. So it just shows how much the market has changed because WTI is much cheaper than Brent now because there is an oversupply of WTI-type oil, specifically shale. So it's a different type of oil that the North Sea produces versus what the U.S. produces. But still, we look at the overall numbers globally. And so a collapse in WTI... doesn't leave Brent still hanging strong.
No.
You know? So it also pulls down the Brent price. And the reason we need below $50 WTI is that we need to stop some of the activity in the U.S. We need less drilling. We need less completion of wells because we need less production growth. The U.S. will still grow in terms of how much it produces year on year, even if we had $40 WTI and say, for simplicity, $50 Brent, we will still see an increase in production in the U.S. However, the world is growing in world demand. So we don't need to necessarily shut off the U.S. completely, but we need to slow down the pace. So at that price, under $50 WTI, we see a slowdown and a limit in U.S. production to around 12 million barrels per year. Now, the U.S. is now the world's largest oil producer. It's bigger than Russia and bigger than Saudi Arabia. So it is actually extremely important how much oil they continue to produce and how quickly they grow. If we get the oil price weakening, which I think we will, because there will be a lot of refineries in maintenance in the first quarter. So as we were explaining earlier, refiners are the purchasers of oil. Mm. The U.S. is still going to be producing more than it is right now in January and February when the refiners are in maintenance. Saudi Arabia will have cut production, but Russia is only slowly cutting production next year because it's difficult for them to cut production in Siberia in the middle of the winter because they risk having pipelines freeze.
Everything is difficult in Siberia during the winter.
Exactly. So yeah. As a result, even though Saudi Arabia, UAE, Russia are cutting production, mm-hmm. we won't see that cut as quickly as would be ideal when the refineries are in maintenance. European refiners are also in maintenance in January, February. So you have less purchasers of a lot of oil still. So that will also put a downward pressure on the price. Mm-hmm. However, once that happens and we have the shale industry slow down, we will then see the oil price appreciate over the course of next year. And that's where, going into the third and fourth quarters in particular, I see quite a lot of strength coming into the market.
And do you see a turning point around summer or sometime then?
Yes, or it could even come a little bit sooner. It depends how effective the production cuts are coming from OPEC and Russia, how quickly the slowdown comes in U.S. production, and then how demand performs. Because right now, the expectations for next year are abysmal for the first quarter on a global macro level. So if we start to see actually that things aren't as bad as they seem in the first quarter, then you know, demand for oil will be stronger and then we'll have evidence of that. So maybe already a bit sooner we could have a turning point.
So short-term pain, long-term gain, is that what they call it?
Exactly.
Well, where can people, our listeners, go if they want to, you know, get faster updates for your oil price or comments about the oil market?
So we actually put out quite regular reports and updates that we publish officially.
On our website, yeah.
Yes, on our website. Mm-hmm. So there we give a lot of updates. And then, of course, our analysts on the E&P side, Tom Eric Christensen, he also puts out updates on how we see things when he's including his updates on actual companies.
Yeah, so I guess your comments about the oil price is included in the Energy Daily mail, actually.
Yes, exactly.
And you can go to our website as our customer website and choose to or select to receive those kind of emails. I think I'll leave it there and just thank you for coming to the studio with me today. Merry Christmas. It will be an interesting season, I'm sure, for both oil producers, oil analysts and oil service companies going into 2019. And for your listeners, if you have any comments or questions, you can always send it. And if you like what you hear, you are free to, or we would like to, if you to share the episode further. Have a nice day.